Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with The Positive Mind, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And I talk about guests. We've had such interesting guests on the show recently. We had Sonny Rollins and Sonny Fortune, certainly people who could teach us a little bit about living through times. But today, oh boy, today do we have a very interesting guest. On the air with me today is Dr. Suzanne Ross. Suzanne, welcome to welcome to WBAI. You are WBAI.
Thank you. I love the station, have been part of it for many years, many decades.
Many decades. Suzanne is known for a lot of things, as well as being a clinical psychologist, educator. She's taught at many of the universities around town, Lehman, Sarah Lawrence, John Jay. Specialist with mid-aged 15 to 20-year-old youth, but not just you know, in the school system. She works. She works by a personal ethic, but primarily, Suzanne is an activist. And part of what she has done over her time is examine the issues related to activism. And activism, I'm just going to, as my own definition is, finding a personal ethic and following it. Finding a something you believe in and taking a role in that thing you believe in. So I want to invite her on the air, and I wanted to tell us a little bit about the background. And I want to start all the way back, Suzanne, if it's okay with you. Mm-hmm. And all the way back is, where were you born?
I was born in Europe. In Nazi Europe, and in Belgium, and by the time I was a little bit over 3 years old, we had to leave Belgium because the Nazis had invaded. And so I spent the next close to six years of my life traveling around the world, to different countries, depending on who would take Jewish refugees in. At that time, I spent the longest period of time of that period in Lourenço Marques, now Maputo, Mozambique, 3 years there, which were very formative, and spent 1 year in pre-Israel Palestine on a kibbutz, on a leftist, what was then considered a leftist, pro-Soviet Union, socialist model.
How old were you at that time?
When I started the first grade on the kibbutz. I spent my first grade on the kibbutz. And when I came to the United States, I was it was the end of the third grade. I was heading toward nine.
And about what year is this? This is all taking?
This is all between 1940 and 19. I arrived in the United States on Christmas Day, 1945, and remember seeing the sky writing, Merry Christmas. And saying, this is magic. I had never seen it before. And then we were taken to Ellis Island because our visas, Jewish people, my father was born in Germany, and Jews couldn't get citizenship. And he must have been the same in Belgium because we traveled, ironically, on my grandfather's visa and that passport. And the visa to the United States had expired, so we had to go to Ellis Island, and I was introduced to cranberry sauce, and thought that was a bizarre food.
Bizarre food, coming from where you came from.
Yes. This shaking red food seemed very bizarre, not to mention the fact that it was really bizarre to have some Nazi prisoners of war in the same place as we were right then.
So now, somehow we're going to find a link between you arriving on Cranberry Island, right, and winding up with being one of the world's leading activists, you know? I mean, you're...
Well, that's overstating it.
You make a lot of noise.
I make noise, but I wouldn't call myself one of the world's leading activists. I'm a serious activist.
You're a serious activist. Now, tell me, just mention the countries you've been to where you have been working for the rights of others.
El Salvador, Vietnam, Cuba, where else off the top of my head?
Spend time Dominican, in Africa
Dominican,
as well?
No, I have never gone back to Africa. I'm dying to and would love to. And I've been in France a few times because of the support that the French have given Mumia Abu-Jamal, and people, BAI listeners, probably those of you who recognize my voice, know I'm on the radio a lot talking about Mumia's case. So I've been in France twice, both when Mumia got honorary citizenship in Paris and when a street was named after him a year ago in Saint-Denis.
And for the people who don't know, say what the case is about.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, for those who are not familiar with the case, is a death row prisoner. He's on death row in Pennsylvania. Has been there for 25 years, was, we consider, many, many people around the world consider him wrongfully convicted and certainly never having had a fair trial, and really in prison and on death row for his political beliefs. He wasn't even, you know, a street fighter or that kind of person. He was an intellectual who spoke a lot on the radio and so on and so on, was a journalist. So he ended up on death row. And
For accused of killing?
Accused and convicted of killing a policeman where there's unbelievable evidence that contradicts the prosecution's version of that, including a major, major document by Amnesty International saying that he never had a fair trial, that nothing matches what they said, and that it's absolutely a violation
became one of your primary causes. You know, but why this particular thing is a primary cause? Why that one? There are hundreds of battles that you fought, but this one really gets your attention.
Well, I've been pretty passionate about my political convictions since I first became an activist, which was in the mid-60s. You grow in your political work, and I was active initially in issues that were massified. You know, I became active in the mid-60s when thousands and thousands and ultimately millions of people were in the streets of the United States. So I was in a movement that, I shouldn't put it like that, but there's an element of safety in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always risk, but still I was with so many people, you know, and religious figures and professors and all that kind of stuff. And similarly, my initial stabs at anti-racist work were also in a period of tremendous activism, the civil rights movement. So relatively,
you were involved
speaking,
with the Black Panthers?
Not in the early days. Toward the end, I was a supporter of the Black Panthers, began going to the trials and so on, was active during the New York, when the Panther 21 were on trial, when Assata Shakur was on trial. I came to court fairly regularly and went to demonstrations in support of the Black Panthers.
Now, all during this time, just as I get it, was your credential as a psychologist helpful? When you walked in, did you go in as a professional fighting these issues, or were you just another one of the gang who was holding a placard?
Mostly I was another one of the gang. More recently, my professional qualifications have really helped me in some very, very critical situations that I was extremely grateful that I had those credentials. I have used those credentials in my political work, and by use I mean legitimately and appropriately, on numerous occasions in the last few years where I was so grateful that I had gotten that piece of paper.
The PhD.
Could make a difference. Yes, and
you
could
know,
make
Dr. Suzanne Ross, to those of you who know Suzanne as Suzanne, right? Dr. Suzanne.
And I've testified in a court case around a child custody case where the state was moving to try to take a child away from the mother and put it in the father's hands, which was a total setup. It was the MOVE organization. I testified on behalf of another activist who had emotional challenges, and they were trying to send her to state hospital, and I came in to testify on her behalf and how valuable she was in the movement and how much we loved her. She's now passed, and my credentials were very useful, both these situations. I recently have been very involved in the prisons, not just for Mumia Abu-Jamal, but I go up to Sing Sing. The brothers there have invited me back on numerous occasions. I've spoken recently during Black History Month. I was there twice prior to that. And when anything goes down in the prisons, and please, everybody in the audience, if you have any credentials of any sort, meaning you belong to a church, you belong to a union, you belong to some organization, when you hear that a prisoner is in trouble, has been beaten, isolated, denied a human right or a legal right, if you call the prison, be sure to use every credential you have. And we all have credentials. Not everybody has a PhD, but people have union membership, you know, and many other things, religious organizations, and those things make a difference. So I've really used that to the hilt. And when I call prisons and say, this is Dr. Suzanne Ross, blah, 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 and I hear so-and-so was just put in the hole outrageously, or you stopped the Black Studies Department, the Black Studies Program, or whatever it is, I usually get to speak to the superintendent and have had some recent amazing successes in making a difference that, again, I feel blessed that I'm in that position to do that. And I try to share that with others in whatever, you know, use me, use me.
We're speaking with Dr. Suzanne Ross. Now, this is a very interesting thing. When we were talking with Suzanne, who's recently been working with me, we were talking about what do we do a program about, and the original program was going to be on activism itself, you know, how to be an activist, what the problems of being an activist are, what you have to face. But the more I keep hearing about Suzanne, I think her life itself is a good example of how you can live a personal ethic. We had on the radio a man who was talking about, a psychologist who was talking about, psychiatrist who was talking about borderline personality disorder. He said one of the key features of the borderline personality disorder is it doesn't have an identity. It truly doesn't have a felt sense of identity. Now, the borderline personality very often will be somebody who doesn't have a conviction on the inside of who they are. A true activist gets a sense, and by activist I mean somebody who stands up for what they believe in and takes an active role in changing something that isn't right according to what they believe. They don't have this sense of themselves. They don't have this commitment. And if you don't have that commitment, it's like a missing hollow as you live. And to this, I want, you know, and I don't care how a person becomes active, including giving contributions. I don't care how they do, but there are so many things that get in the way, Suzanne. Can you tell us some of the things that get in the way of a person following their ethical path? And by ethical path, I mean their commitment to what's right.
Well, there are different challenges at different stages in life. So there are challenges that you face in your 20s when you might be considering becoming an activist, and there are different challenges when you're in your 50s, say, or 60s, or whatever. So in the early stages, when you're trying to decide whether you're going to pursue a career, whether you're going to go to college, say, even at 18 or 19 or later, or whether you know, how you're going to deal with the economic necessities of living in the society, you might be scared to take a certain stand which closes off other doors. I remember being up at the Columbia during the student uprising at Columbia. I was working on my PhD at the time. And I was a little older than the students, and I wasn't part of that scene. So I was very reluctant to get arrested in a situation where I didn't know people and wasn't part of it. On the other hand, I felt so strongly in support of the students and thought what was happening there was so important in terms of the opposition to the war in Vietnam, the opposition to racism in Morningside Heights around the gym that was at that time being built for the students primarily in the Harlem community, with the Harlem community having a separate lower entrance. I mean, all those issues really resonated for me. So I would come there every day and every night, be there till late, and ultimately was protecting one of the buildings when they were about to be arrested. And I remember a cop ending up in the air somewhere and landing on grass, and nothing happened to me, but that was the most physical confrontation I'd had. But I was getting my PhD, and I thought, well, if I get arrested, is this going to mean I'm close to getting my doctorate? Is this going to mess it? So I couldn't throw myself completely into it out of those. But interestingly, despite the fact that I had held back, the chairman of my dissertation committee was so angry at my activism, because he knew I was involved, that he resigned from my committee. This is, like 3 months before I'm supposed to appear for my orals. He resigned and said he would have absolutely nothing to do with it anymore. And I learned something from that, which was that, you know, once you go halfway, you may as well go all the way, because really you're taking the same risks in a certain way. The very thing, I didn't miss out on getting my PhD. I wasn't thrown out of school, but I could see what it was about. Then, you know, their choices, fear, you know, my family was very, not conservative exactly, but conservative about my safety and conservative about not going a certain route of at least professional respectability. They had given up on my being respectable in every other way, but still there was the respectability of having a PhD and also their needs. My parents by that time were getting older, and so there's pressures, you know, what if you get arrested and are away for several years, and, you know, bad parents and so on. And then there's just the psychological fear. All my life, literally all my life, since I must have been about 4 years old, when I first learned about concentration camps, I began training myself mentally for confronting what I knew was the bad guys out there. The enemy. And for me, the bad guys are always Nazis, you know, since that's the earliest thing in my life. Mm-hmm. When they were carrying on about communists, I never, you know, I could never get myself worked up about any enemy. They were always the Nazis. And, of course, today we have something resembling the Nazis in this country. Not exactly. It doesn't look the same, but it has some of the same elements of early fascist development. But early in life, literally at 4 years old, I remember saying to myself, what if they came to get my mother or my father or my brother? What if I saw them doing something horrible? Ironically, I saw them doing horrible things right there in Mozambique. When I was 4 years old, I was in Mozambique. And I saw chain gangs in Vasco da Gama Park in Lourenço Marques, where I remember just staring that grown human beings would walk in chain gangs and take care of the gardens. I remember my mother took me to the local prison to pick up somebody who had been working for us, who had been without a pass or something like that. These were the same as apartheid laws. So early in life, I didn't stand up to that. You know, I didn't go over the chain gang and say, let me break those chains out like my granddaughter talks about doing to Fumumia. But I was looking and was outraged. And the anger was beginning to grow in me. And here I am, what if they came from my brother or my father or my mother? So I always try to prepare myself. And will I have the strength to stand up when it's right in front of my face? During the civil rights movement, when John Lewis, who's now a congressman, who has gone very far astray in many ways from what he believed in many years ago, he just voted against and abstained on a vote on Mumia in Congress that was heartbreaking to see someone with his history go that way. When John Lewis got concussion after concussion fighting for voter rights in the South, I would look and say, John Lewis is my hero. If only I had his courage. And that courage builds up with practice. The first time I was arrested, I was standing next to Dave Dellinger, who's now no longer with us. And he was a nonviolent pacifist activist, a very militant pacifist. And I saw how he dealt with the police. This was in front of the Pentagon. And I tried to imitate what he did. I literally saw him getting arrested. He says, I will now be crossing you nonviolently or something like that. And I said something similar, only because I'm much smaller than he is. I went under the police, the security's arms. You know, I snuck under them and went straight for the building. And I remember feeling ecstatic at having overcome. I mean, the Pentagon is so ominous looking. I was just there 2 weeks ago again. And these police are so big and so evil looking. And when I was actually taken to the jail, local jail, I couldn't stop dancing in the prison, literally with other sisters who were arrested, because even though this was a serious action, it was not a joke, I was personally felt so triumphant having overcome my fears.
Suzanne, you know, it's the interesting thing is that most people who that I've seen who feel like taking an active role against something very often have a lot of issues with their own families that they haven't resolved. And most often people who feel a symbolic opposition to their fathers decide to take that against something. So, you know, they're going to now fight the injustice of, when they're really dealing with the injustice of their childhood. So a lot of activists I know have a lot of unresolved early childhood stuff that's motivating them. And then there's a lot of others who have that motivation plus the pure motivation. How do you separate the two? How do you know if your sanity is not going to... Will you please settle the issue between you and your father? Or would you please settle the issue, you know? I mean, because sometimes we can convince people to stay on a path that may not be in their best interest. I know a man who was against fur coats. He was an animal rights activist. And he used to attack women who had fur coats on with spray paint. And he once blinded a woman. He sprayed the paint right in her eyes and blinded her. And that was it. I mean, the penalty wasn't no penalty. She didn't, you know, it didn't go anywhere from there. He lived with that and he kept defending himself. This is right. This is right. And what he was really fighting was about the injustices in his own family, because that's what led him to become violent, actually.
Well, that's a very complicated question, so let me...
Sure.
Give me a little time to answer it, okay?
Good, good.
So, in the 60s, during the period of the highest level of activism in this country in my lifetime, because I wasn't here in the 30s when that was... I wasn't on this planet yet, there were psychologists and theoreticians who... I believe Kenneth Keniston was one of them. The one I remember was Kenneth Keniston, who wrote about how the activists of that period were really just rebelling against their fathers. And I really take umbrage at that approach. I'm not saying that's what you're saying. I'm saying that that's an approach to activism that I find really undialectical, very simplistic, and basically... Sometimes when I've heard people say that, I actually think they're being paid sometimes by the government to put this out as a mass ideology. In the 60s, that was thrown around a lot. So, but on the other hand, as someone who prides myself in thinking dialectically, I do think some people, I don't know what percentage, go into becoming activists out of rebellion against, out of anger against the father, or sometimes the mother, or whatever, you know. But, and I think some of that's legitimate. Some of that's legitimate. If you look at Wilhelm Reich's writing, and he's not so much his psychological stuff, but his theories of fascism. To me, Wilhelm Reich was a master theoretician. Master theoretician. By the way, Samori Marxman, for those of you who know and remember and love Samori Marxman, was an admirer Wilhelm Reich. And he and I used to talk about Wilhelm Reich a lot. And there are two books in particular. One is called The Mass Psychology of Fascism, and the other is called Listen, Little Man. And both books talk about the family structure, the authoritarian family structure that he was talking about Germany at the time. But we can take that to the United States. The authoritarian family structure where the children are supposed to obey the father and the mother plays a secondary role, I mean, in terms of authority, but the father is the father, the father, the father, the father, and the father can be a tyrant. And I think to rebel against that is wonderful. And if that rebellion leads you to understand injustice and objectively understand how to relate to that in the bigger world, all power to you. So that's a progressive way of using the repressive aspects of family structure. And perfectly legitimate. Now, if you're forever only thinking about your father and fighting your father and you don't have an analysis of anything bigger than your father, like the state, the institutions, the repressive institutions and so on, you're stuck. You're stuck. You haven't moved very far beyond it.
Is your job as psychologists sometimes to help people sort out the battles that they feel that are internal from, you know, the battles that they're taking on that are symbolic?
Well, yes, but more important, I would look at it somewhat differently, more important, and I was going to get to this, is the context in which you work. And the great revolutionary Che Guevara defined it and hit it right on the head, and that's why people still quote him so many years after he's passed, which is that a revolutionary... and I'm paraphrasing, must be guided by feelings of love. And to me, the word love is central to true activism and certainly true revolutionary practice.
She's certainly hitting this on the head. So when you say the feeling of love is the motivating force, does that mean when you're confronting those with whom you disagree in one form or another, that you don't hate them?
If the main emotion that guides your work is hate, you're not going to inspire other people, you're not going to set an example.
What else is it besides that? Besides that, if the main emotion is hatred, you're saying, yes, you're not going to inspire. But if it's hatred, then it means it has to have history inside you.
It has to have history inside you. And it's also, it doesn't mean that you started with that. But I know people, and, you know, the movement is the progressive movement in this country has its strengths and weaknesses, and it has amazing people in it, like Samori Marksman and Safia Bukhari, whom we're going to do a tribute to tomorrow night, and we'll announce the event. And people like Pam Africa, that I work with very closely, who is exudes love, and insists on love being the motivating force in our collective work, because and it's what works.
Okay, so may I ask you, even though we're going to take a short break and come back, so you would say you do love George Bush?
No, I don't.
Well, you don't hate George Bush.
I'm not consumed with hatred for him. No, I'm not consumed with hatred for him. Do I love him? No. I think he...
Do you have love for him, as opposed to do you love him? Can you find the love for George Bush?
I mean, if he came to my office as a patient or a client, and I got to look at the role of his father on him, the impact of his father on him, and saw what a pitiful, desperate person he probably is deep down, being a tool as he is of people who are in control and who are, and yet I would definitely see the unbelievable amount of death and destruction that he has brought on this planet, and would have to hold him responsible. So I could not love him in the sense of, all right, let me just listen to your problems. I would probably be pretty confronting.
So
some fluke he walked into my office, I would have to contain my language, as I have when I've seen people in the movement or anywhere else with racist practice.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean I have not loved people who I have seen practice and embody many, many aspects of racist society. But I can't ignore it. I can't ignore it. Not only can't I ignore it, but so I think the question of do I love George Bush? No, I don't love George Bush.
Well, you see,
I want him, you know, it's
the question is, if love is your motivating force, does it stop at any point? Of course.
Yeah, it does.
Of course
does.
There are people where...
It stops. It stops at some points. George Bush is certainly one of the places it stops.
So
when I saw Adolf Eichmann being an amazing film where he's just on the screen for 2 hours, I looked at it. I looked at him psychologically. I understood that he was truly a cog in the machine, thought he was pitiful in a certain way, and remembered what he was responsible for. And the same with McNamara. I saw a film of McNamara where he's interviewed, and he looks a lot like Eichmann.
Well, good, I got you started. We're going to keep talking more about this. We're going to come back with the issue of love and hatred, and as it affects many of these things that inspired this remarkable person, Suzanne Ross. This is Armand DeMille. We'll be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friends. And this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're back with Suzanne Ross. And we're talking about the psychology of activism. So, Suzanne, could you take us along this path a little further as to, I'm talking about love being a motivation, and I'd like to ask you about this because I think it's there, and I know it's there, and I know how many times I have been in the middle of killing situations where people were poor and being victimized, and there I am in the middle of it and trying to help one way or another and taking a stand one way or another. But somehow there's a piece of you that I am sure, even in the height of your wrath, of your anger, comes through as a love that comes from you. for the world.
I hope so.
I hope so. That's what I aspire to. And I try to surround myself with people in my work in order to proceed and do work in the spirit that I want to do it. I try to surround myself with people who are not only positive in the way people use the word positive, but are motivated by feelings of love. I've been very, very fortunate in the last 10 years or so, maybe a little more, working, ironically, in the movement to free Mumia, where here's this brother who's on death row, a wonderful human being. Talk about being motivated and guided by feelings of love. He exudes love. His messages exude love. And not for his jailers, though he talks respectfully to those who speak to him respectfully. But for humanity, for his people, for his children, for other people's children. He drew a picture. He sent a card to my granddaughter, who's 5 years old, and has heard about Mumia, of course, and is very, very upset that he's in prison, and spends a lot of time thinking, trying to figure out how she's going to free him or how she's going to work with us, and is a little critical of me for not having freedom yet. She gives me credit for having tried when she lists my positive qualities. It's one of them is that I work to free Mumia, but she pointed out recently, but Mama, as she calls me, you haven't freedom yet.
Mm-hmm.
So when she, you know, in her own little scribbly handwriting, she wrote him some notes. He wrote back a beautiful little note to her and a drawing of a dog, so geared to a 5-year-old, with such love in that card. At one point, somebody must have told them I was either not well or something. It's a few years back. I can't remember. I got this beautiful picture of a singer, a jazz singer, that he thought would lift my spirits or whatever it was. I can't remember. He didn't even say anything. I don't think, just love. And Mumia does that. This is from death row for 25 years. Now, that is what I call revolutionary love, that he has not allowed this criminal, barbaric, racist government kill his spirit, is the triumph of love. It is ultimately an incredible, incredible triumph of love. That's the kind of example that inspires me. I hope that my practice and my work offers that kind of example to other people. I aspire toward that. And that's what you have to surround yourself with. Now, do I see people in the movement who are full of anger? Yes. And do not exude love? Yes. Do I see people who seem absolutely crazy, who are in the professional language, acting out conflicts in relation to their parents or their siblings? Yes. How do I deal with that? I say, oh no, here comes another one. And it is depressing, and yet it's the reality of living in a capitalist society that does not nurture and foster good family relations, that does not support good interpersonal relations. And we're not living in the revolutionary period. We try to build a movement that embodies those same values that we'd like to see in the new world. And we're not there yet. And we see a lot of people who are filled with hate in the movement, a lot of people who are counterproductive. And one of the reasons is because well, all the obvious things I just said about capitalism not really nurturing positive relations, to say the least, and nurturing a level of competitiveness and individuality that's extremely destructive we're trying to destroy capitalism, so obviously we're trying to build the antithesis. But in the movement, one's needs are intense. If you're going to be against this most powerful government on this planet, if you're going to be subject potentially to counterintelligence activities, which this government engages in all the time, which are not only, you know, eavesdropping and the things that have been revealed around the pre-Republican convention work that they did and all the kind of, but also the divide and conquer strategy that they use. We know that during the time of the Panthers, they would spread rumors about one person to alienate another and try to break up relationships and build distrust. Well, they're doing that right now. So when you're working and you need support, when you're fighting this government, you need support, And people say might be hostile towards you or insulting you or undermining your work. You have to figure out, is this someone who has a genuine criticism that I should listen to? Is this the enemy causing trouble? That is a big challenge. The level of reality, hold on reality, that you need to be able to do this is extremely high. You can't just be la-di-da, you know, going through this spaced out or, you know, into a million things and not paying attention. You need to, as Bernard White says, pay close attention. You need to be paying close attention all the time. You can't miss a beat. You can't miss a beat.
So and part of the problem is many people feel, I'm sorry to interrupt, many people feel, Suzanne, that if they take the role of righteousness, they don't really shouldn't have to be able to deal with anything. They're just going to be pure and right. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, well,
you
no,
can't do
sorry.
That. And when I first became an activist, a serious activist, a full-time activist, was really around the early 70s. When I began understanding and transforming myself, and I said to myself, well, bourgeois psychology is really bourgeois psychology. It's not meant for revolutionaries, not meant for activists, and I'm going to throw all this stuff out. I really don't want to be. And I remember I went to Cuba. I was telling a friend of mine the story yesterday that when I went to Cuba in 1973, the Cubans, of course, knew I was a psychologist. I went on an academic delegation, asked me to write something on psychological developments in the United States. And I thought, what do they want to know about psychological developments? You know, I'm not going to talk about that. I wrote them something about the left. And they came back to me and they said, we asked you to write something about psychology and what's happening with it. You know, we're trying to use some of the psychology here in Cuba. We have kids with problems, teenagers who are dropping out of school. And I've had to learn that lesson again and again because when I was telling Mumia about this the last time I visited him, and he said, I said, you know, I used to throw psychology out, and he said, that's like pulling your eyes out. Why would you want to pull your eyes out? And psychology is an important tool if you use it in the context of what you're trying to accomplish and what you're trying to build. And I tried, again, dialectics. How do you become a serious activist committed to a total change of the society while not giving up tools that can be very useful. So I've come to really appreciate what I know about psychology and the fact that I've been able to help not only in these examples I gave earlier where I've been able to use my credentials in ways that protected people who were in trouble in the society, but also in terms of people I see who come with various challenges, and I can help them with that. But I'm saying in the political context, you know, I'm not talking about myself as a practitioner of a discipline in which I do for a living. I'm talking about in my political work, even there, making an assessment of whether someone's acting crazy or acting hostile toward me because I did something wrong, politically made an error, or because this person is off the wall, or because this person is in some kind of rivalry with me because I remind them of their sister, and we're fighting for some mother's love somewhere or other, or whether, you know, all those kinds of things, or whether someone who's exuding rage and anger in every meeting that you're sitting with that person in, and you know this is not contributing, I have to figure out what I'm going to, you know, what can be done, and who can respond. Plus, it's a more sophisticated assessment, not only where it's coming from, but what can be done, as Lenin said, what can be done.
When you, Suzanne, you know, as a psychologist and as a psychotherapist, and I know you have a private practice and people come to see you, and many people I know, I've sent people to you, especially when they find that it's hard to get motivated, if they have a goal in mind and they want to get motivated, I say, well, who better than Suzanne, you know? But when they come to you and you do see people eventually, doesn't some part of you wish you could wake them up and say, what are you doing socially? You know, that you're going to feel better if you get active socially, that you're doing something that counts?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. And I appreciate that question because, yes, I do, and yet I don't do it like that. I don't do it like that because then I'd be feeding into the family dynamics that often happen where the parent, you know, why don't you do this and why don't you do that and why don't you be this or that, what I have in mind. And you have to really respect the process of somebody going through their own development and their own way of finding how they can contribute. And there are many ways to contribute. There really are many ways. There are people who are incredible artists who contribute, you know, in unbelievable ways. What would we do without music, without the beautiful music? What would we do without the poetry that makes a difference and helps us keep going on? So there's no one way. I can say this is the way for me, but there's no one way. But I can help people take certain risks, learn to take certain risks, develop the inner strength to follow their own muse or path, which is really, I'm not saying I can always do that. I'm saying that it is possible. Let me take it away from myself. It is possible to help people feel the strength to go beyond what they would go, given what schools teach you. And, I mean, the level of fear that's instilled in the high schools of New York City in kids, it's criminal. Criminal. And if you start me on that, Armand, I'm going to be here for another 5 hours. And
I see it also brings tears to your eyes because
it
hurts.
Yeah, it really does. It really does.
What is the part about that?
Because young people are the hope of the future. Young people, when I first studied psychology, whether you read Anna Freud or Erik Erikson or anybody, they all talk about the idealism of young people. I often do not like the way they talk about it. Sometimes they talk about it as though this is a passing stage and this characterized adolescence, but, you know, you learn to be realistic by the time you're 20 or 21 or whenever, and then you no longer hold on to that. But, so I don't agree with that. But the idealism of 15 and 16-year-olds, the intense moral stance that they can feel, if not take, is destroyed out of them. And it's like killing the life of our youth. And this is not by accident. This is the way you get people not to fight back, not to speak up, and to go along with the system that really means death, because the kids I've been working with have been inner-city youth, mostly black and Latino. And this kind of disillusionment leads them to where? Drugs and prison. And leads them to not take the risks that would transform their lives and make them be the John Lewis's of this generation or the Mumia Abu-Jamals of this generation. And those weren't the last ones. You know, it's not like we don't have right now Mumia Abu-Jamals somewhere where we may not have. We have, in the Mumia work, I just want to say this for a minute because it's so important. There's a young person who came to us when he was a senior in high school, came from a suburban, well-to-do professional family, had all the privileges that anyone could have in this society, but came with soul and morality and passion and intelligence that could see the horrors of this society. And I don't know how he'd feel about my mentioning his name, so I'm going to hold off for now. He's under enough attack by the police. They've identified him, too. And he plays an incredible role by having made that commitment. And so you don't have, though many, many people who rise up come out of oppression and experience, you know, my own experience with Nazism, people having experienced the racism, seeing their parents humiliated by a racist system, women having seen women being abused and all that, their own experience. There are also people who hook up on some other level. You could be, so for those of you listening who may come from privileged backgrounds, don't feel you've been fated to not speak out and fight injustice. Those privileges can be used, turned around, and used in a very positive way to help liberate yourself from whatever has imprisoned you, and to help liberate others.
We're speaking with Suzanne Ross, Dr. Suzanne Ross, and we're talking about the role of activism and the kind of things you go through. We could probably talk forever, but before we continue, Suzanne, I do want to make a mention of what you're doing tomorrow night. Now, again, you know, it's going to be up at St. Mary's, right?
Yeah, St. Mary's Church on 521 West 126th between Broadway and Amsterdam. And right across, so you feel really safe, right across the street from the police station.
Good place to be.
Yeah.
Good place to be. And this is Samari Marksman's
sister. This is a sister named Safia Bukhari, who used to have a program with Sally O'Brien, Where We Live, on WBAI, but who's a phenomenal revolutionary. Died at age 53 from total overwork and 24/7 dedication for decades. She became an activist at age 19, joined the Black Panther Party, ultimately the Black Liberation Army, the Republic of New Africa, tried to help some incarcerated Panthers escape from the tombs, ultimately escaped herself for a short period of time, was captured again. When she was released from prison, she did not stop for a minute. The rest of her life was to free the others who remained in prison. And this sister taught us so much by her example. Again, I've been blessed. She was one of the blessings in my life.
And what about Samori himself?
And Samori was a brilliant, brilliant, unbelievably dedicated internationalist.
For those who don't know, Samori Marksman was the director of WBAI for a number of years and a man I knew and obviously knew very closely.
And Samori, I remember being, as a matter of fact, I was with Safia and we were having a meeting for some reason at BAI when it was on 8th Avenue. And there was some kind of fire scare. And we all ran to the staircase. You don't take an elevator, right? And I can't remember what floor it was on. And Safia was having, by that time, was already beginning to be, she was having trouble walking down the steps. And we get downstairs, and Samori's not behind us. And I'm thinking, where's Samori? Where's Samori? And people are joking about, you know, the captain stays on the ship and all that. And he finally came down. But he literally, his love for that station, and it was not abstract love. It was rooted in his understanding of the importance of having a progressive station like that, where he could get the message of revolutionaries around the world onto his daily, I'm trying to remember the name of his program. Michael G., tell us the name of his program. But his program...
Behind the News.
Behind the News. Yeah. Thank you, Michael G.
Oh, my goodness. It's so good to hear you, Susanna. It's really a pleasure to hear you and to hear Armand talking to you about this and, in fact, you bringing this event up about these two very, very special people, special to us here at WBAI. Samori, very special and dear to me. I remember seeing you at his funeral at St. John the Divine. Those years ago, and so it's good to hear you, Suzanne.
Thank you, thank you. I remember something you said to me once about the kids we had on the show. I don't know if you remember this. I was taking over Bashir Mshawi's program on a Thursday night. I had a bunch of high school kids in the office, in the studio. That's what I did with the show, and they were talking about their life, daily life. It was something I was referring to earlier with Armand about what high schools are like, and they were talking about how the spirit is killed out of them and what's happening to them. And one of the young sisters, who she was about 18 at the time, had just graduated, she said, "I served my time, and you did a double take. You kept talking after the show, 'served my time,' talking about school, 'served my time.'" And I'll never forget your reaction, because I'm used to the kids saying that all the time.
I remember it as if it were yesterday.
Yeah, me
five
too.
5 minutes ago.
Me too.
She said, "I served
my time.
She was talking about in high school.
High school. She had graduated from Norman Thomas High School, which is considered not one of the worst high schools.
Thank you, Suzanne. I'll back out, but thank you, Armand, for allowing me in here.
Well, Samori's commitment to getting the message out about to helping people see beyond the United States. I mean, Americans have such an U.S.-centric view of the world. I have some hilarious stories about that from my travels. But Samori, concretely, day after day, would bring messages from Angola, from South Africa, from Cuba, when the Soviet Union was falling apart. He understood what that meant. in a way I didn't. I was listening, and I heard Samori wasn't a blind supporter of the Soviet Union by any means. But when the Soviet Union was falling apart, he understood the consequences for the world, which we now experiencing with mm-hmm. the unipolar domination of the world. And he knew how important, and like Safia, he knew that everything he did made a difference, and that the less he slept, the more he was doing stuff, the more he could do. But there's a trap in that. There's a trap in that. And it's true that the Samoris and Safias, every minute they spent was worth it. But it wasn't worth losing them. It wasn't worth losing them. We've lost both of them in their early 50s. Both of them. And to this day, it's hard for me to talk about it.
I can't imagine how Samori would have paced himself slower. I can't picture it. I mean, I know that that was what was necessary because we all watched him speeding his way through this. But I can't imagine him at a slower pace. You know, he wasn't crazy active. He was just active.
Yeah.
He was living it 24/7.
But it's like,
do you ever have to catch yourself and slow yourself down?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Tell me about it. What do you have to do?
I would not have lived this long if people hadn't stopped me various times and say, you're going to have a heart attack or a stroke. You've got to slow down. So I'm pretty speedy still, but you know, I make sure I exercise. I make sure I eat properly. I make sure I have time to nurture myself, whether it's with my granddaughter or a close friend or a lover or whoever. I make sure that I make sure in the middle of everything that I see my family, which is scattered around the world, because I need that support. I do things to take care of myself. And I wish Samori and Safia had, even though I think every second they spent was a contribution. So it's complicated. You understand why people overwork themselves. You understand that there aren't millions of people like that. And I'm not knocking it. But at the other hand, the heartbreak they caused and the loss of their not being here is incredible. When Safia passed, I told you this earlier, I thought about it, and I wrote in my tribute to her, she's irreplaceable.
You know, family and being connected seems to be essential. I think part of what it takes to be a successful activist, meaning making a difference, is you have to feel like you belong, you know? It's almost like, this is my family and you're messing it up, is the attitude that I feel so often about any of the role I play. You're messing up my family. It's like that you're taking away that which is sensitive to me. The other day I talked about how it's almost you're not allowed to admire the American flag anymore or sing America the Beautiful because they've taken it away from us. And my feeling about you is that you have such a sense of belonging to so much between you and your family. Would you say to all the people that feel like they want to be activists that if they feel like they're going to do it in a separate way, it's a big loss because it's important to have the support of your...
It's indispensable. You need to have support. Now, some people get it from their families. My family's not particularly political. I was not a red diaper baby or anything like that. Much of my family is Zionist, and we have unbelievable fights, and they know what I do to oppose Zionism. But there's a fundamental love that I've been able to nurture and maintain. I was fortunate. Not that there haven't been losses in my relationships and my family. There have been, too. But you need to surround yourself with either close friends, a support system, comrades. You need to have love in your life and nurturance in your life and people who accept you and who respect you and will hang in there with you when you're saying, oh, my God, I can't do one more thing, or I need a month's vacation, or I need 3 years' vacation, people who will understand what that means. And you need that. And some people get it from religion. I want to say a word because a lot of leftists are against religion, and I'm not a particularly religious person in the traditional way. But I know Safia Bukhari became a Muslim and was a religious Muslim, and that was a tremendous source of support for her. And there are many forms of that. So don't let anybody knock the way you get your support, as long as it's not destructive to yourself or others. And that's my message. Love, love, love.
Suzanne Ross, the incomparable. I'm so pleased to know you, Suzanne. Had an interesting experience. You know, every time I've ever spoken to you, I like you more. It's because you're going to keep going on for a long time. So this is Armand DeMille with you. It's a Positive Mind. If you want to hear this program, you can go to WBAI.org and listen to the archives, or you can go to thepositivemind.com and get the archives from there. Suzanne, is there a way for people who want to be involved in some of the things you're involved in for people to contact you? What would be the best way?
Absolutely. Call 212-330-8029. I'm going to repeat it. 212-330-8029. Leave a message. If you want to speak to me in particular, leave a message saying you want to be contacted by me. And it's a hotline, but Tibby Brooks picks up the messages every day, and it'll get to me. You can also do it through our website. This is the Free Mumia Abu Jamal Coalition website, www.freemumia.com. So please, feel free, join us. Join the worldwide effort for justice, the worldwide struggle for justice.
Sponsored non-commercial community radio. The more you listen, the more you know.